It's The Wonky Show from Poland. We're live tonight from a bar in Krakow, where we'll be sharing our learning from our study tour to the Visegrad countries, plus new insights into the disabled student experience. We'll get across those and those news on the renters' rights bill. It's all coming up.
If I was going to the library and I saw that gnome with a celebrating Christmas and reading and studying, I think, wow.
What's bringing you a step?
It's one of us. I'm going to do my dissertation now.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. Host Jim Dickinson, and here on our study tour around the countries of Hungary, Slovakia, Czechia and Poland, four fabulous guests. Katie Jackson is Faculty of Humanities Officer at the University of Manchester Students' Union. Katie, your highlight of the tour, please.
I think my highlight was when a university in Budapest took us up to a panoramic room, which showed the whole of Budapest, which was very interesting.
There you go. Some photos in the show notes. Sean Keeney is Academic Officer at the University of Limerick Student Life. Sean, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight was being in a meeting room in Prague that hasn't been, or the design hasn't been changed since it was built before World War II.
There you go. Again, photos in the show notes. And Gary Hughes, he's Chief Exec at Durham Students' Union on his 104th study tour. Gary, your highlight of the week, please.
I've got a cautionary tale about data for you, Jim. My Sainsbury's wrapped Nectar Point thing showed I'm the number two purchaser of tea bags in the northeast of England.
There you go.
I want to know who's number one.
Maybe the novelty of travelling has worn off for Gary. And Mac Marshall is Community and Policy Officer at Wonky. Mac, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight was when we did a very, very long, quite fun tour of a film school in Poland, and we somehow managed to bump into a somewhat famous Polish director.
There you go. So we start this week with disabled students. Disabled Students UK has published its Access Insights survey results for 2024.
Yes, so there was one more present after Christmas. In this survey, we got about 1,200 responses from disabled students across the UK. And obviously, it's covering issues like assessment, campus accessibility, facilities and disability declarations. Now, this kind of core stuff here is all about reasonable adjustments. And Jim's gone into a lot of this on the site. Kind of some of the key stats here is that half of those respondents have reported that adjustments that providers for their assessment for their student experience were insufficient to put them on an equal footing with their peers. 43% were experiencing that staff were treating agreed support as optional, and around a third felt that they were pushed from one person to the next and to the next because it was so unclear as to who was responsible for addressing their needs. Now, about 40% agreed that the majority of staff outside of disability services understood what their actual legal responsibility was in terms of making those reasonable adjustments, and about 6 in 10 of those who had adjustments agreed reported that they had gone without some of those adjustments.
Katie, you must, there aren't that many student leaders around the country who are specifically responsible for a kind of chunk of the university, a kind of faculty. You're obviously one of them. You must come across all sorts of tales of students who are kind of pass pillar to post, and you know, they get their adjustments agreed and then they don't get delivered. And
100%, and I think that is a huge problem all around the UK, but I think there's something about getting students to report in the first place, which I think is a huge problem everywhere. And I think, I mean, someone said to me the other day about using the word disabled. Some students still are concerned about using that word to describe themselves. So that is something that I think is a huge barrier for students in reporting. And I think that there has to be more adjustments put in place for students. Some campuses still aren't accessible by wheelchair, and that is something that people have to get on top of as soon as possible.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the results have got both physical disability stuff in there in terms of campus accessibility, and also, you know, I mean, over the past few years, significant increase in mental health disabilities and learning disabilities and so on. Sean, what's the picture like in the Republic of Ireland? Are we a particular outlier here and everything's fine in the Republic?
I don't think you're unique in this. I don't really have stats to back this up, but just from my own experience in my role and dealing with students and dealing with my university, I know that it's not accessible. We do have accessible doors and everything there in place, but the majority of them aren't working and they're reported to us, and we're actually going through an audit at the minute of the accessibility in our campus, but it's not up to par. And then when it comes to more like neurodivergency and like trying to get diagnoses, to fully get supports in the universities, you need a diagnosis, and the waiting list for these diagnoses are massive. So it's trying to help out while people are waiting for a diagnosis. That is our kind of biggest issue. I don't think the UK is unique in this. I think the same issues are kind of seen in Ireland at the minute.
Gary, there's obviously two things going on here. Part of this is about, the kind of implications of this relatively high profile legal case, this Abrahart case, where at least in theory, it would be problematic for a university to kind of routinely say, well, unless you've got, some sort of external verifiable medical proof, you ain't getting your reasonable adjustments, partly because they're supposed to be anticipatory and partly because other evidence presents. But the other part of this that's probably more shocking is even when students have got the adjustments agreed, it doesn't kind of manifest, that agreement doesn't manifest across the institution, does it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the duty to anticipate is really important because there are some things you can do without having a particular student in front of you. But when you do have a student in front of you, the minimum expectation I think we should have that isn't statutory or regulatory is that you remain in contact with that student, you listen, you learn, you have a relationship with that student, which isn't just you stage a case, here is a set of things, now off you go, I hope we don't hear from you for 3 years. Like, if there's an understanding that learning and assessment and the nature of HE requires ongoing discourse with a student, then the assumption that many of the cases you cited in students who have been let down by the system in the past, what I think we must learn from that is that it can't just be a one-off intervention as if you're giving somebody a library card. It's about adjustment, and the thing we know about any form of navigation or design of any form of system is you continue to adjust. I think the sense from the report that Max spoke about, that people speak about their low experiences and satisfaction of ongoing dialogue and support, is what stands out for me, in that there is just no sense of relationship with disabled students. It's just about compliance.
And if you look at the Student Academic Experience Survey from HEPI and Advantage, just over 6 months ago now, it told us some really bleak stats about the number of disabled students who are coping with mental health issues, that are thinking about dropping out, and their feelings of belonging and so on. This isn't news to us, and we've got not a great deal of institutions now signed up for the disabled student commitment. But what's striking about all of this is, and you've picked up in it already, Jim, is that these are all pretty much legal duties under the Equality Act. They just aren't being regulated on in the same way that other duties might be. And the solution here isn't about making sure that we're hitting 80% satisfaction on a survey. It's about making sure that universities across the country are meeting those legal regulatory minimums, which are that students should be able to access reasonable adjustments without the need for diagnosis and so on, which are all these things which have been outlined in the Abrahart case. What needs to really happen now is we need to see a lot of those key recommendations which have come through Abrahart case, which aren't necessarily going above and beyond some of the existing legal duties, i.e. the Equality Act, actually put down and systematically regulated across universities. Looks like we need a more of a harder touch approach rather than how many universities can sign up for another commitment or charter.
Now, Katie, I guess if I was to do a compilation album of all of the things I've ever said on the podcast, I would get accused instantly of, well, it's always stick with Jim, never carrot, right? And, of course, it's easy for Mac to say, universities need to be harder regulated on this and so on. But in another part of our brains, universities are really strapped for money right now. it's not as if it feels like lots of people got lots of capacity to do extra things.
I think there's a part here. I mean, I studied sociology, and one of the modules I studied was called Inequalities in Contemporary Society. And the only thing that wasn't massively discussed was disability. So I think there's a broader thing here about curriculum and about teaching people about what disability is and what we need to do for people with disabilities. But I think there's that. But then there is also this, jumping through hoops that it just makes the actual journey to getting a diagnosis. And I mean, the university that I'm in stopped diagnosing students because we did have that in-house, and that's stopped now. And that is that's putting an extra barrier in place that is already there. So I think that there definitely is a limitation on, the amount of money that universities have to do things with what they've got. But I think that there are key things that have been missed out in the past that I think should have been taken into account. But I think there's more that we can do in the future about actually targeting what does actually need to change. Where can we take funding that was meant to be in something else and put it? I mean, you know, the Access and Participation Plan said that there was a huge problem with disabled students are the biggest gap at the moment in most areas of the faculty. And I think that just shows, and that has increased post-COVID. Mm. So it's something that has to change, and it has to change now, really.
Sean, obviously we've spent the day today in a country where students' unions are specifically mandated in law to tell students what their rights are. And yeah, I mean, it's not clear to me either in the UK or in the Republic of Ireland that students in general or disabled students specifically understand.
Let alone student rights. And I think a system where students were mandatory, like it was mandatory for them to learn their rights, would be amazing. But like we heard today, it's not mandatory and a lot of students don't get involved with this. And I think that's kind of relates to the problem with engagement in the union or in like student governments. So I think to try and like inform students of their rights is what we try to do anyways, but to try and find the correct way of doing that and trying to make it mandatory maybe would be the best way of doing it. But looking at how to engage these students would be the most important thing.
Gary, one other thing on this, which is one of the countries we've been to this week, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was two kind of advocate roles inside schools and faculties. One, a sort of general, something approaching what we would call a course rep. And the other was a disability advocate. Yeah. Disabled students up the whip and have conversations and do this sort of thing. Is there a role for, and we've also, of course, this week come across international student reps that weren't themselves international students. Is there a role for that sort of student-led doing this sort of thing on a social solidarity basis rather than what we might call a kind of self-representation basis?
Yeah, the self-representation basis is the foundation of a lot of the way we work, particularly in student organisations, but university organisations will clearly want to have leadership of the race equity charter by people who are from minoritised learning backgrounds and so on. But it's been really striking that when we've asked questions of that nature to people in Europe, they just don't understand the question. Mm. They just want the work doing. And I think there's something about the understanding that people who volunteer within an organisation want to do the work because the organisation has to do the work. And it's much better that the work is done rather than looking around going, we've got one person who is disabled or who is international. It's much better they fail. We'll feel authentic as long as they ever go, even if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Now, with disabled students, of course, there are particularly reasonable adjustments necessary for volunteering work. You know, that is something which the work of undoing a lot of the problems or drawing attention to possible solutions that are on a policy or institutional level might require people to reflect upon the way that's done anyway. You can't just advertise a meeting in the same way you would for any random academic or professional to do it. I think my view, Jim, is that the work needs to get done. And I think that the legitimacy, the authenticity of that work will be really important. You'd want to do it with the consent, participation, oversight, contribution of disabled students. But there are, you know, university leaders, student leaders, who are talking on behalf of people they don't represent. You know, Katie's spoken about coming from a humanities background. And it's lovely that Manchester has that ability to focus in that way. Or the students speaking, student officers and vice chancellors, who have to speak on behalf of scientists, as well as linguists, as well as historians. And they just crack on. You know, I've never seen a vice chancellor go, I'm really sorry, I'm not a mathematician. I need to get like that. It's a job, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think we probably do focus over much on the way the work is done in the UK. It's been really refreshing here to just go, why would we make that more complicated than it needs to be? Just crack on.
Okay, I guess the other thing that really struck me the other day when we were in Slovakia is that students can, within some boundaries, kind of take as long as they like to complete their degree. Now, of course, in the UK, it's pretty much if you've got 3 years worth of credit, you have to complete them in 3 years. And the reason I raise that is, of course, the number one reasonable adjustment that lots of disabled students get is extra time in their assessments. But, you know, one of the pieces that we ran on the site earlier in the year was I'd sort of spoken to about 30 disabled student officers over the summer and got them to add up all the extra time that they were sort of given by the university. And it's huge chunks out of their life that other students are using for, you know, kind of self-care or, you know, social experiences and so on. Is, you know, let me kind of ask you this question. Is it still the case in lots of universities and crucially in a university like yours that assessment design isn't changing much and the number one thing is, well, I'll just give them more time?
I think that's absolutely right. And it's something that I'm particularly passionate about. I think that something that came up recently is we signed off a policy about that students had to complete a degree within 5 years. So that's with either a placement year and then an interruption, which is what I'm doing. And I think that I've really struggled with that. And in that process, I voiced a lot of, you know, what about if something horrific happens? And that's in like the worst case scenario. But there are, as you've just said, students who are dealing with a disability, which might mean that they have to take that time out. And I think that it's such like a crucial thing that we just don't have. We do not have that flexibility in the UK. I'm not sure about the Republic of Ireland, but we really don't have that here. Not here, sorry, back in England. But I think it's really tricky because getting an institution to change the way that they do things completely, it's hard enough to get the small things done, never mind something like that. So I think that with assessment design, that's where it has to start. I think it has to start with, okay, how long are we going to allow students to complete this piece of work? And it can't be just saying, oh yeah, you get 2 weeks extension. That's not possible for the disabled students in some cases. You know, sometimes it is taking months out at a time. So I think, yeah, that is something that universities need to really consider and understand that, you know, not everyone's life is just complete university at 21 and then go on to do whatever they do in their career. Sometimes it's harder than that. And
straight away.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And actually the graduate outcomes stats bear that out for particularly for certain categories of, you know, physically disabled students, saying that trying to get suitable accommodation was often costing them significantly more than everybody else. Now, you know, clearly if you're running a kind of halls of residence and all students lived in halls of residence, like it's, you know, decades ago, you can see what the solution to that might be. But in the grim reality of everybody's housing crisis, including in, you know, cities like yours and certainly in Dublin, that is really tricky stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the shortage of accommodation is kind of everywhere and the housing crisis is really hitting a lot of the world at the moment. But especially when houses that we would be living in my university, which is the main way of living, private homes that are like semi-detached houses or detached houses, they're not fit for purpose for anyone. So and they're not accessible for disabled students. So they really don't have an option and they would be forking out well over double the price of anything that anyone else would pay.
Great stuff. Plenty more on the site about all of that. Now let's see who else we've been talking to this week.
You are with Matus Lukečka. I am a vice chairman of Student Council for Higher Education in Slovakia. My main agenda is PR, so public relations, and my main job is to be in touch with public.
Ace. So we're sitting in a bar in Bratislava and reflecting on the day in the middle of the tour. And it would be great, me and Matus thought we'd have a chat about some of the highlights of our conversation with delegates today. So I want to kick us off. What do you think are the biggest advantages and challenges of studying in Slovakia?
As we were talking today, a big advantage in Slovakia is a price for accommodation. It's like in my university, it's like 70 euros. A month, and we have public transport really cheap. When I'm talking about trains, we students have free trains. So I would say that this is one of the big advantages to be in Slovakia. And in my opinion, Slovakia has really quality universities. So there is nothing like Slovak University has no quality or so. And the negative thing to study in Slovakia is that Slovak universities are not in higher ranks in international ranks. That's kind of sad because I think Slovak universities are really has qualities, and that's why a lot of students are going abroad. They are going to study abroad and they don't stay here. So the problem is the brain drain here and a lot of factors are just these these ranks, international ranks.
And obviously one of the things we spoke about with this idea of brain drain in Slovakia, and I wonder, like, if you could talk about the free trains as a really fascinating intervention, but what kind of things do you think are done for students to try and combat that students leaving the country? What are some of the initiatives that you think really work in Slovakia that's retaining young people?
That they're keeping them here in Slovakia. For example, we had program like a stipendium for students that will stay in Slovakia. It's like 9,000 euros if you stay in Slovakia and you will stay and study here.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that wants to keep Slovak students here in Slovakia. And then there are a lot of maybe benefits for people that are already working or has are waiting a baby.
Yes.
You can have individual study plan, and you can like work and still study.
No. Yeah, and we even discussed this idea of being able to forgo teaching if you're in particular jobs and only sit assessments. What's that about? How does that work?
Sorry, what do you mean?
So if you were in a particular profession or if you were working while you were a student as an accountant,
yeah,
or you were studying accountancy, you would be able to reduce the intensity of teaching and just do exams.
Yeah, yeah. If you are working in the field that you are studying, you don't need to go to school. All you have to do is just complete the exams. Some teachers have some, like they want you to do some homework or something just to make you make sure that you are learning and you are looking into books. But the main idea is that you will just be working, and if you pass the exams, all exams, then you can get your degree if you want to.
And I wondered whether we could talk about, to go a little bit more in the student politics side of things, but also the institutional governance side of things, the system of in Slovakia of having the student chamber, the Senate, both at faculty and university level, of your role in Eshkereveshe. You're going to have to edit that one, Jim. I wonder if you could tell me about like your role in Eshkereveshe and also in terms of the student chambers in Senate and faculty levels at university, which is like a strong amount of student representation. Could you talk us through how that representation works and the kind of things you talk about?
Okay, I will start from Senate. The first Senate I will talk about is Faculty Senate. It's the small one. We call it the small one. It's just on faculty level, and we are solving the faculty problems. Like when students have problem with maybe some, they are missing something, like maybe microwave, or they don't like the prices of washing machines or everything, you know, on faculty. Then you can just tell them there and try to solve problems. On your university senate, the large one, the great senate, there is that's on the full university level.
And so do you have like a strong influence in that senate? Does the senate listen to you?
Yeah, I would say in my university, it's true that they are really listening to students and their needs. And what I forgot to mention is that a small Senate is voting or have election for dean. And the large one, the great Senate, is have election on rector.
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of big vote.
I'm moving up and out of the institution. With the National Committee.
Yeah.
You're effectively part of the subcommittee of the Ministry of Education. Is that right? That's how I read it.
Yeah, it is right.
And do you have similar influence there?
I would say yes. It's their responsibility to learn from young people and to hear students, because the Student Council for Higher Education is like voice of students. So what's the better source of of needs of students than this. These are people, students that are active in students' life. They are interested in their universities and faculties and senates and everything. So who is the better source of information than this? So if the ministry wants to improve education, then they should listen to this voice of students.
And what kind of things have you been speaking about with the ministry?
About maybe some new laws. If they want to make some new law, we will get that law. And we are talking about it, we are discussing it, and we will send them with some repairs, or how should I say it? Like, we just say that this isn't a good idea to have there. And they are like, okay, we will do it anyway, or okay, we will get rid of that if you don't agree with it. But it's on discussion, you know, you need to discuss and be diplomatic in this.
Now, the Westminster government has announced some amendments to the Renters' Rights Act, but there's still some problems in there, Katie.
There are. So just for anyone who doesn't know, there's been, so just as a quick summary, there's a couple of things here which I think are really key for students. So there is now a ban on fixed term contracts, which, you know, in my university career, it's always kind of been 10 months. Which is always really, really awkward. And then there is also a ban on taking more than a month's rent up front, which for students who are already financially struggling, I think is a really good move in the right direction. However, some students, I think, will struggle with this, I suppose, lack of flexibility. Because, for example, your maintenance loan, in England at least, comes in kind of termly. So it does help students to manage the finances when rent does come out termly. So I think that will be an adjustment for students to kind of, if they have been paying rent termly, it'll be something new that they'll have to manage their finances in a different way. And I think there's stuff that we can do there as a university and as student unions in helping students with that. Also, I suppose there's still problems with landlords might still discriminate against international students anyway. I think there'll always be that problem. But I think that these are things that the government still needs to solve. We need to really get down into those, rip it apart basically, and say, you know, these are things that you need to really think about.
Gary, I guess one of the questions here is, you know, if you take that example that Katie raises on and termly rent or monthly rent, we might have assumed, given the huge number of students inside the private rented sector, that, you know, there have been extensive conversations between the Ministry of Housing and Communities and the Department for Education, and that we are just days away from an announcement from DfE about changing the way in which you can get your student finance, surely.
You'd hope so, wouldn't you? But unfortunately not. I think the Ponzi wonks is thinking about how the sausage is made, and the government is going full tilt at so many significant pieces of legislation that the capacity for departments to speak to each other in the best of times was tight. And we have to acknowledge that this is not the best of times. Economically and legislatively, the government has few options in front of it. Now, I think the important thing in terms of what DfE is contributing perhaps to this agenda is the soft power stuff. So I think I was really pleased when looking at the amendments that Katie listed, that it's been really clear that some influencing by student unions in particular, but also universities, I'm sure, has meant that the names on the amendments are particularly university towns. So I was really pleased that Mary Kelly Foy, the MP for the City of Durham, has sponsored a number of the amendments that Katie spoke about. And when they go to debate, I'm sure they will be in the chamber speaking about it. Now, the challenge, of course, for the Ministry of Housing and Local Government is that the interests of various people contributing to this are not just students. And the points that DfE would talk about in terms of the impact upon some of these amendments on perhaps how the academic year is structured, or perhaps how mid-semester recruits or PGR students in particular might be able to fit into the housing market. The Ministry of Housing didn't create this bill for students. It created this bill for the millions of people who are in terrible conditions. And because of very important reasons, students are now in there, and the student test test is a really significant way about going, how do we define a student home? You know, I'm a part-time student at a university. I'm fairly certain my home is not a student home, but it's really important. But we can define it, and this is the first attempt to do so. So I think that there's much in this to be optimistic about, but we do know the passage through Parliament is going to be frantic, just because there's so many other things this bill needs to do. But if it doesn't hit the student interest in this, by which we can actually say this is the institutional interest, this is the DfE sector interest, that would be a real missed opportunity, because the DfE doesn't move housing legislation.
Yeah, sure. I guess, you know, I mean, there's kind of three, certainly in my head, there are three categories of student accommodation, right? If you're living away from home. One is halls of residence, either private or public. One is living in a house, sometimes in a house share. Sometimes you sort of move into a house and you are sharing. It's just, it's not a joint contract. And I guess the other one that is starting to get really big in the Republic of Ireland is living with a family, you know, the kind of digs thing. And of course, if you then have legislation that makes it better for people in the middle one, presumably that means that there will be a huge, even bigger competition for the one bit of that market where families themselves, the sort of people that Gary's talking about, families that, you know, are competing for the housing. And that's not going to do civic relations any good whatsoever, is it?
No. I think tensions are quite high, especially in the estates, because they are private estates, specifically spotted around the campus. And tensions between families and students have never been higher. Obviously, there is like, an anti-student kind of agenda, I guess, around our campus and in my city. And in community liaison committees, it's kind of used as a forum to vent and rant against students. We feel like we're being attacked. The local council is actually coming into these estates and giving out parking tickets to students. So you could be looking at €80 pop for a ticket. And already this semester, I've gotten 3 tickets. So you can imagine how, and I'm working, so it's okay. But for students, it's impossible. And local councillors in my area are attacking these students in the press, whereas they can literally park nowhere else. So they don't have any other option. We have an increase in commuter students trying to come to college. If they can't get to college without a proper parking, they're going to have to drop out. And we've seen this. And they have nowhere else to park, but they're being attacked because of this. There just isn't the right kind of facilities for students to actually go to college really anymore, which is nuts.
I mean, the thing is, Mac, he's moaning here, Sean, right? But he does live in a country that actually has a national student accommodation strategy. We have in previous years visited countries that have national student accommodation strategies. We haven't ever been to Spain on one of these study tours. Just before Christmas, it announced a national student accommodation strategy. What would it take, do you think, for us to get to a point where the UK, or at least, you know, depending on whether it's the, you know, whichever ministry, maybe it's
videos on the BBC of students queuing outside of letting agencies at 3 o'clock in the morning. You hope it's stories like in Ireland where students are going out flyering, asking, will you let me stay with you? Apparently that's not enough. And I sound like a broken record, and I've said it everywhere and I'll say it again. This government clearly doesn't understand what it's like to be a student in 2025. It has changed remarkably from even all those ex-officers that we've now got in Parliament. We've got more MPs from urban university towns and cities, but they still don't get it. And this is coming through everything that Katie said about kind of the maintenance loans in England, but around those housing stories. I genuinely believe that until enough students and universities, I think universities have a really big role to play in this, because they're the ones that are recruiting the students. They're the ones that are or are not sometimes bed planning for the amount that they recruit and thinking about kind of the size and shape of the city. Until people start to join forces and work a bit closer with their local combined authorities, hoping for some more with this, with the devolution bill, to actually get those student stories in the room and start saying, look, this is the reality of what student housing looks like right now. And we need to have, as you said, Jim, an actual strategy to sort it out.
I think Mac's point about the devolution bill is really important, because, of course, the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government is housing and local government. And that is the opportunity for clever ministers. You know, Big Ange has got to have some thinking about the fact that half the department is thinking about housing and the other half is thinking about the powers the Metro Mayors have. We're really lucky to have Metro Mayors who are actually interested in social housing in their region. And actually, this is probably an opportunity for us to think about. London is possibly not the only solution for a lot of this. Housing strategies can quite rightly be in the northeast, in Greater Manchester. And it's probably a challenge for our sector to realise that not all solutions run through London.
Kat, your one final vision is going to be proper enforcement of the decent homes standard. and I'm just not sure. I'm not sure the Landlords Association is ready for. I'm just not sure anyone's ready for what happens if suddenly the actual decent home standard was enforced, either by helping students to sue their landlord for the endless tales of black mould that we hear, or the kind of rats, or the freezing cold, or the repairs that never get done. I mean, you must have come across all sorts of tales in Manchester of genuinely awful, and not young ones funny, genuinely unsafe housing.
I mean, literally all of those things you've just listed, Jim, I have experienced in the houses that I've been staying in.
What are the chances?
I know, honestly, all of them. I think that, you know, it was a bit of a shock for me because we had a great second year house. I mean, it was just great. It was people that were looking after us were great. And I don't know how we happened upon that. I don't understand it because I was hearing all these horrible stories from my other friends who were living in Greater Manchester. And then now I understand is that the state of it is just awful. And as you say, it is unsafe. There's no other word for it. I mean, at the moment, it's not too bad where I'm living, but last year it was just, I remember us coming back this time last year to a house that was literally completely flooded. And I mean, the landlord literally came in and painted over it. There was no repair done whatsoever. And it was completely our fault the whole time. And I think that is when you're so stressed with finances, student jobs, your degree, you know, everything else that comes with being a student, being away from your family, you know, and that's a home student. That's not even talking about the things that international students have to face. Is I just think it's just wrong. And I really worry about how this is going to be implemented just because we are so far away from that.
Now, finally this week, we've been travelling through the Visegrad countries of Hungary, Slovakia, Czechia and Poland, as well as a little Brucey bonus visit to Bucharest for a few of us. Gary, what did we find?
I think what we found, Jim, was, as ever, something where you recognise the quality of what is out there if you go to look for it. The real upside for me, I think, in all the countries that we found was the number of student representatives who actually quoted the law at me. Like, one of them really apologised for it and went, I'm a law student. And it's like, good. But we were talking about people who could talk about the basic law of their state, which said students have this right. Now, we've spoken on the podcast about renters' rights, and we've spoken about disabled students' rights. The core of it in a lot of these countries was that they could point to the fundamental things that students are entitled to in terms of good teaching, the right to be consulted, the right to have somebody explain their rights to them, the right to have a certain amount of time spent on them, the right to have another go, all that sort of stuff. I suppose the downside to what we found, I suppose, is you recognise that in the UK, we are fighting so many, I suppose, transactional fights. And it occurs to me that when we think about what Jackie Smith's got on her plate for the next couple of years, it's about the funding of the HE system. And, you know, I've worked in student unions for a long time, and it's always about money, isn't it? We can never move on from the funding and finance conversation. So we never talk about actually what is anybody walking into an institution entitled to in terms of their education. And we found loads of it. The only thing I'd say is that the quality of student leaders is always so inspirational. I'm sure others will talk about the welcome we've received from people who are volunteers, who when they get an email from the good people at Wonky saying, can you give us a couple of hours of your time, pull together a group of people who just want to be enthusiastic and positive about their place. Later on in this session, we might talk about some of the particular things, but it's just that volunteers give so much to their institution and their community. And I'm just happy to see you. And I think that is just something that really struck me about the malaise we sort of have in the UK about the problems we have. But it's not that they don't have problems, it's just that they're cracking on with stuff and they're doing it with a little smile. I think that was really impressive.
And also, Mac, extraordinarily well-dressed.
I mean, that's not what I took away from the whole trip, I won't lie to you. There's a load of stuff I could talk about. There were so many student like volunteers, as Gary said, like who just talked about this need and this want to help others and want to volunteer and want to make things better. But the one thing which I found really fascinating, and Gary's already touched on this, about specifically in Poland, is that in the law, there is a Higher Education Act from a couple of years ago now, which explicitly outlines what student rights are. And Sean's already mentioned how this is something which they are mandated to be trained on. It's different levels of kind of efficacy. But just for a big bit of context, these look very similar. Well, some examples of these are like students have the right to
to get a reassessment, to take part in strikes in relation to their education. They've got access to unlimited resources, can take absences in classes, transfer their credits. It's like a super-sized B condition. And it's wonderful. But what's amazing about this, apart from the fact that students can advocate for themselves, as well as, bonus tier, go to a student ombudsperson to advocate on their behalf, because what's more scary than a random university academic who says, here's how you do a resit process, an actual student person that can go, here, I'll walk you through it. But what I took away from this most, obviously all this stuff in the Act is amazing and is really cool, and it's cool to hear how it kind of translates in the different contexts. But this is a government act which outrightly says what student rights are. And it's not just about the rights. It also says they have to put on these big festivals every year for students. They have to do induction and adaptation days, they call them, for students. These are students at the heart of government's eyes, not kind of at arm's reach of a regulator, as it is in the UK. It feels like government really, really treat students as citizens and want them to have the best time. And the one land, because it's the kind of the consumerization of education, they're paying fees, right? They're not. They're not in Poland. This isn't because they're consumers and they're entitled to this because their toaster broke and they need a new toaster. Apologies for my repeated toaster analogy. But why is it? I don't know. It's just cool. I love it.
But let me just ask you about that, Matt, because I often get a sense, partly I think because lots of the sort of entitlements and rights stuff is accidentally kind of wedged into consumer protection law. That when you talk about student rights in the UK, people sort of roll their eyes and, oh God, they're already very entitled. Read some stuff on the bus earlier on about, you know, students being very entitled and all this kind of stuff. But is it just me? I've not picked up a single scintilla of a sense that the idea that students have a set of basic rights then interferes with community and reciprocity and a decent relationship with staff.
Yeah, 100%. Their rights are kind of just there as foundational. And the academics we meet, the universities we meet, see their relationship with students as a constant process of co-production, of seeing students as partners rather than this kind of, the fact that they've got their rights enshrined, the fact they're trained on them, surely they will be adversarial. Surely there will be this constant conflict between their rectors and their the students. But no, there's a real sense of community and of coming together. And it's such a juxtaposition, especially right now where you're seeing the OFS consulting on their new strategy and their eye statements and things like that. It's just worlds apart.
Yeah. Now, Katie, it's been a long week, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's been so eye-opening, and that's the only way I can really put it, to be honest, because I've been lucky enough to see a lot of higher education institutions across the UK, but you know, to go to a country where so much is different, but also some of it is remarkably the same. Like today, for example, they spoke about the bureaucratic systems that are kind of in the way of them making change. And I just thought, wow, that is still the same. But as Max said, and as Gary said, they just crack on. Like it's different where, you know, they just get on with it, and they've got this like motivation that I think we've had the question maybe four or five times about what motivates you to be a student leader. And they're just like, I just want to do it. I want to help. I want to be that person. And I think that that's something that we don't, I know that that definitely isn't what I say to myself every day when I walk into work, you know, and I think that that is something that I've taken away from this. It's like, just remember why, you know, what is the motivation? And I think that's really important. Also, when I asked a question about kind of what the biggest challenge was, I think this was to the student union in Budapest. They said that the biggest challenge they have is finding harmony between things. And I thought that they put that in such a way that I've never heard before. It was like finding harmony between students who are studying and then working, and finding harmony between mature students and the university, and, you know, finding harmony between things. And I thought, no one's ever put it that articulately before. And I just thought it sounded really, that is what we need. We need harmony. And one last thing is, I found it really interesting. There's this real emphasis on family-friendly universities and student parents, which I feel like we talk about a lot in student unions and perhaps a little bit in universities, but I do feel like there is a lot more emphasis on that here. And that's something that I took away and thought, one, I wonder why, you know, and that's something that I'll probably ask over the next day or so. But also, what is it that they are actively doing to make sure that that's the case? It was, yeah, just really interesting all around.
Now, Sean, with that putting words into your mouth, you must be having a proper meta experience, because in theory, what happens on these tours is you go and visit some people in another country, And you know, you have to spend a bit of time kind of working out what is the same, what's different, and reconciling the terms and so on. And then you get back on the bus in the safe cocoon of everyone's experience is the same. But of course, you and your colleague from University of Limerick are on the bus with a bunch of people from the UK in a different system. And you must, I can't, you must, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely been tiring because it's all go. As soon as you wake up in the morning, you meet up with the rest of the group and you're just exchanging information. And for instance, like you could be tired in the evening when you get on the bus and you actually just want to dig into conversation with someone. And there this evening, I spent the hour bus journey from Katowice to Krakow, just digging into conversation. But the differences I've noticed are the difference between us and the UK aren't as different. Obviously, the tuition fees was stark when I was talking about them. But the differences between us and the countries we have visited have been crazy. And I think one of the main things has been accommodation and the dormitory style living that these students are living in, especially in Slovakia, where they have kind of in Bratislava, they had this almost student-like city just outside of the town. And there was about 7,000 to 10,000 students that could live here. It's like a small city for students with amenities, like small chapel, a print shop, food shops, clubs and bars in around the dorms, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. But I think what really shocked me was the price that people were paying. Yeah, the price that people were paying in these universities, depending on the quality of the accommodation, was around 80 to 130 euro for each person per month. And this kind of accommodation is like first year students have guaranteed, but second to third year is based off a point system. And I've kept hearing point system everywhere I go. It's like it's a 1,000 point system, 700 points were for academics, so based on your grades, 200 was for engagement in extracurriculum activities like clubs and socks, and 100 for accessibility and socioeconomic issues. And I just thought this kind of space that for students was absolutely amazing. And talking about student spaces, when we were in Prague, I was absolutely blown away by this kind of almost cultural student crossover with the city. So this crossover with the city was like an interdisciplinary space for the uni to meet with the public. And it was holding student activities, but also activities that the city would put on. So it was initially a derelict building that was had a bit of a violent past. And the arts faculty of Charles University asked to take over this space and use it for their own. And they actually made this space into something beneficial to the city. And the rest of the university kind of got on board. And then businesses were getting on board. So now they have this space for students that's rent-free for students to use for their kind of clubs and socks and to host events like political events, science events, and kind of music events. And I just thought this kind of space in the middle of Prague, in the middle of a massive city, was amazing.
And I guess, you know, I mean, there are cities right across the world, but certainly in the UK and Ireland, that and certainly towns that are increasingly looking pretty sparse and empty with retail leaving. There must be something in this, I guess, for the next few years, at least having, you know, having thoughts about what sort of spaces there could be in the centre of cities rather than just in campuses, aren't there? I guess the other thing, Gary, that I've been kind of in kind of subconsciously on the back burner interrogating all week is, obviously we have seen fairly recently post-Soviet countries. And, you know, some of the architecture, some of the stories, certainly that I've been reading about on the bus and writing on the site, you can see how some of those threads, even though they're post-Soviet countries, feed into some of the practice now. But I guess, you know, the other part of that for me is, you know, if nothing else, what lots of that kind of Soviet system was about, and lots that's terrible about it in terms of communism, but some of it was, you see real evidence of planning everywhere, don't you?
They did love a plan, didn't they, famously, the Soviets? I think where that played out for me, Jim, that's really interesting is the extent to which, in Hungary in particular, there was an ongoing conversation about universities which were or were not subject to state control. And by state control, you imagine in the UK, imagine, you know, with all of our panic about academic freedom. You imagine like the Minister of HE going, don't look at that. And actually what they mean is somebody going to fix this when it breaks? Like they literally mean like when a building needs building, is somebody going to build it?
actually the you don't want to downplay like the historic precedents, but you do want to put them in context that they were hundreds of years ago. In the countries we saw, they're just supported by government. And the extent to which that is post-Soviet, I don't care. I just like some government support. You know, I long for the days of Hefke's building fund. The other point, I suppose, is how that understands their work in terms of student number control, which is obviously going to be something that I think we will revisit in the next couple of years as an ongoing debate, because they are able to talk about the number of students they need or want in particular places. There's a really interesting example we saw at Skoda University. In Czechia, which in a market space was created. So actually, I think there were really interesting examples about where a government is really clear that they don't want to go back to being Soviet. You know, they are really clear that they want a free market. And we didn't actually have, I think I was a bit surprised that people still wanted to talk about that. You know, you certainly go to some of our countries and they are really clear that the past is in their past. I think we spoke to some people on this journey who wanted to learn from their past and not repeat it, but also didn't want to actually throw everything out. I think the final bit I would say is that planning, yes, investment, no. So we saw some really shiny investment in some places. So we're in Poland now, and one of our colleagues is Polish, who's on this journey, and speaks about the change she had no idea about had happened when she'd been living in London.
Yeah.
But we also saw, I think, as Sean said, some dormitories which just needed refurbishment. And what really struck me looking at these big buildings that homed must have been 400 people in one building is when that goes, there's a gap. And actually, in terms of what that means, like where is the space? There is no space. So I think investment is interesting. But you did see in a really positive and constructive way, there's big signs saying the European Union has helped us. Not to go very political, but you raised communism. I think it was really interesting that that was just a positive thing. It wasn't like our government is like, the Arts Council must be grateful or it will be closed. It was very much like, we are grateful because we are sharing resource. At Katowice earlier, as Sean said, the Vice Rector for Education, I think was her job, was speaking about the benefits they've achieved from being the European City of Science in 2024, and actually the ability they've got as part of a network of 9 universities across Europe to do exchanges and collaborations additional to the Erasmus framework. So planning is maybe post-Soviet, maybe current EU, maybe facilitates a lot of this. But I think the UK lesson, I think, is you don't need to be concerned about when people come to help. Mostly they do not want to shut down your course. They just want to make sure the roof's not leaking.
Mac, I guess one of the things that I'm also really interested in on these things is how people become students, right? And, you know, some of the previous tools have been, you know, big things about student tutors or, you know, blah, blah. But, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of the kind of some of the stuff we've seen this week about that those first kind of crucial few weeks?
It's obvious to us already that those first crucial, it's obvious to most of us that those first few weeks at university are huge. It's kind of make or break for most students in the UK. But here, what we've seen is the kind of like these big camps, these big fresher camps, often relating to kind of drinking and partying, but also sometimes it's an entire week of induction material, like overload them with as much information as possible, tell them everything they need to know, and then we constantly build on it throughout the week. And what's interesting about these experiences, so for example, in Poland, they do these kind of adaptation camps, which is essentially a freshers week, but often away from campus. Same thing actually happens in Hungary. And it's kind of pre-arrival. It's an opportunity for students to get to know each other before they get onto campus, relieve some of those anxieties, find out a few things about their student government, but also where student services are, recognize a few buildings. But what struck me most about this, apart from that these are just good things to do in general, and we do replicate some of this in the UK to varying levels of success, is that students watch student leaders put these on, and then they see themselves in that and go, I want to do that for somebody else. And it's the constant thing we've seen across all these four countries. And Jim's mentioned before about how this has happened quite a lot on all the other study tours, is people see other people do stuff and their first response is, and I want to do that in the future. And it's this kind of community thing. And I don't know if it's a European thing, but one thing I did note was this kind of, my answer to this is always, well, that would never work in the UK. Students and peer mentoring schemes are sometimes kind of the classic example of it, is that students have become far more individual and society has become far more individualistic. So that kind of sense of wanting to help others doesn't always exist, but it does in some clubs and societies. But one university we were speaking to and one student government was saying, we've moved so far away now from saying, this will look good on your CV. Yeah. And if I had a pound for every time someone in the UK said, to try and get a student to turn up to something, this will look good on your CV, I'd be rich. They said instead of kind of focusing on the value for them, they kind of reframed it and said, let's not talk about CVs anymore. Let's talk about why this is just a good thing to do. Like, not just for you, but for everyone. Like, why is this a good thing? And reframing it. And I know this isn't a toolkit for like solving everyone's engagement crisis, but it does kind of shift those values more towards community and less towards your LinkedIn.
I guess, you know, one of the things that again has come up a lot all week, Katie, is this idea that there's a kind of set of substructures at sort of faculty level or school level in some cases and so on. And you know, here's a test. You know, you are a full-time student representative of a faculty, but unless I've missed something, you haven't got a big, huge Faculty of Humanities committee. You don't say you're the Faculty of Humanities Student Union. It's not a Faculty of Humanities community that then feeds in. You've just been elected as a kind of subset. What are your thoughts on that kind of constant thing we've seen all week on, yes, you start with the faculty and then...
I mean, that is something which in each institution we've been to, which I think pretty much most of them, if not all of them, have this faculty, they call it the Faculty Students Union, which I find, you know, as a student union, which at the moment we don't have that in place, you know, it has been a bit of a shock. And I think it's also been probably a blessing in disguise because, I mean, we've kind of been thinking, you know, this is something we definitely could do. And I think it's that because especially at the institution that I'm in at Manchester, each faculty is completely different. They work in completely different ways. They have completely different staff structures. So why do we not have completely different student structures in those spaces? And I think that that's what this has taught me in particular, for, you know, to take back to Manchester, is that we need to have that in place because we know the institution isn't going to change overnight. The university is not going to change overnight. But what we can do as a students' union is say, okay, how do we adjust to this? And how do we say, okay, let's get a faculty students' union in, or we'd probably call it some sort of faculty committee or faculty forum. I mean, what we do have is our school reps who within the faculties at Manchester, you have schools. So we've been trying to kind of meet with them more often as a group. And that is probably how it starts. And I think so that there have been, you know, it's kind of started, but it's how we now take what we've learned over the past few days and say, okay, let's take that.
Be the mascot.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. For each faculty.
Mascot, shield, the logo.
100%.
And your own crap quiz in the first week.
Always, always.
Sean, I guess, you know, the other thing is, and I don't know whether this is true in the Republic of Ireland, but I often feel like we've convinced ourselves that students won't do anything for each other, right? You know, you have to pay them, or they're not going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, all four countries, higher percentages of students work, certainly than in the UK. And, you know, one of my sort of cognitive dissonance moments always is that when I was, you know, from the background I'm from the area I'm from, honestly, it was the working class communities that were the, you know, that had the least amount of money that would always spend the most amount of time kind of helping each other out, just not necessarily in formal organisations and so on. And I guess, you know, the question I was going to ask you was, what are your thoughts on why it is that a set of students that appear to be just as, if not significantly more economically disadvantaged, are giving their time to other students in this way?
What I kind of got from it, and I think my quote for this entire trip and what kind of made me step back was, I think it was in Gyor when we asked about the motivation to kind of get involved with student government and what your motivation to do this was and what your motivation to help other students was. It was like pride, and it felt very nationalistic, and I'm proud to do this for my university because this is what my university does for me. And I think he used the quote, ask not what you can do for your country, but what your country can do for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite a moment, wasn't it? Now, all four of you, one unusual thing, amusing thing, terrifying thing, one final thing before we...
I'll follow on, and my thing will be following on from Sean's, actually. Prague City University, which is a wonderful little place, literally above a shopping centre in Prague. There's only 500 students. It's an up-and-coming university. The first slide from the student council president said, we are so proud to be associated with Teesside University. It was like, I've gone on these trips for years, as Jim said, and been to 20
different countries on this. And they were just so genuinely heartwarming. It was, I got a little tear. So I emailed the university secretary, Teesside University, and said, these folks absolutely love it. Some of them have been to Middlesbrough, loved Middlesbrough. Now I come from the university next door and we've got graduates coming, you know, from all over the world. Well, the fact that somebody just went, I need you to know, we love the UK and Teesside because they're flexible, they're affordable, they're something I love. And I did not expect that in Prague. It was beautiful.
Mac, something kind of unusual, interesting is a lot of the universities we've been to have all had kind of like little mascots and little icons all around. So in Poland, we've seen like loads of, I want to use the word Smurf, but it's not Smurf, is it? Gnomes. Yeah. Gnomes. Gnomes were everywhere. And there was a very nice little gnome outside of the library at a university in Katowice this evening, which had a Christmas hat on and some books. And now I'm wondering whether this is actually what Jim was after from this question.
Are you hallucinating at this point?
No, that actually happened, I think.
But why are the gnomes good?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit like at York, isn't it, with that duck that dies. Yeah. Rest in peace. People like to rally around like an underdog, a hero. And do you know what? Maybe if I was going to the library and I saw that gnome with a celebrating Christmas and reading and studying, I think, wow.
Put a spring in your step.
It's one of us. I'm going to do my dissertation now.
One thing that I found unusual, especially in the state of back home, is the fact that they have free transport in quite a lot of places, but particularly in Slovakia, which I find... Was it Slovakia? Oh, wait, let's start again.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. Okay. Yeah, it was.
I'll start again. One thing that I found really bizarre, especially with the state back of public transport back home, was the fact that Slovakia had free public transport for anyone under the age of 26. And I think that is the most unusual thing I could have possibly seen because we are so far away from that. But I think, you know, it's interesting to see how much they value actually getting their students to where they are. And I think that's the key thing there. It's like, you know, if you want students, you need them to be able to get to where... Sorry, I've read you wrong.
But I tell you what, Katie, the thing that's most interesting to me about that is that was introduced by a populist president. You know, we have come across countries, you know, we've been in, and, you know, part of it was in the manifesto that FICO had, it was students are part of the kind of downtrodden. Students and their families need support. In the UK, we still tend to think of students as the elite, the rich. Oh my God, you know, they're living it up on a student grant. That kind of positioning was very interesting, wasn't it, in terms of students need the support?
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny actually, because I've told this story quite a lot on this trip, but my sister, who is a financial advisor, she just for context, she kind of said to me, I was telling her about the sector and I was saying, you know, it's in a really rough state. And she went to me, no, it's not. They're all, you know, they're all rich and talking kind of about us as universities. And I was like, no, I think you're seeing it from, you know, and some universities are lucky enough to be in an okay position, but that is not the way that the whole sector is. And I think that there is this perception of, you know, students are rich and, you know, but so many people are able to go to university now, which is absolutely amazing. You know, my own background, you know, I was from a working class family, first in my family to go to university. I'm so glad I got that opportunity. So it's kind of like, you know, yeah, some people are, but also it is a diverse community and we have to cater to everyone's needs. And that is the kind of long and short of it, really.
Now, one from you, Sean.
I think one of the most shocking things that I heard the trip that kind of made me laugh was when we were in a technological university in Slovakia, and an important question was raised about mental health issues and the supports available for students, and we were shut down with engineers don't have mental health issues.
but that was so interesting, wasn't it? Because, you know, I guess, you know, there's lots where we're like, oh God, you know, if only we had X and only we had Y. But certainly one of my reflections was, if I think about the sort of extent of and sophistication of mental health support in both the Republic of Ireland and in the UK, you know, we can moan a lot, but I mean, there's the universities we've been in have not been anywhere really close to the sort of space we're in back home, are they?
No, I think a part of that is the conversation around mental health. And I think that's been really important and really, it's been massive in the last like 10, 15 years in definitely the Republic of Ireland, from my experience anyways. I think that conversation definitely increases the chances of getting that support. And I think the support's available for students especially
has come on leaps and bounds in the last 10, 15 years.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to go in deep on anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Katie, Sean, Gary, Mac, Michael, Salmon, who also makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.